Welcome to the FemTech Health Podcast. Today, we're joined by Dr. John Sturgis, a pioneer and leading expert in regenerative medicine. We're going to dive into all things related to regenerative medicine, including PRP, ACP, musculoskeletal ultrasound, and the future of regenerative therapies. You're going to learn about the importance of using your own blood for healing, the advancements in molecular biology, the role of ultrasound in guided injections, and the potential for insurance coverage of regenerative treatments. All right, let's get started with today's show.
I'm here today with Dr. John Sturgis. He is a pioneer and a leading expert in the art and medical science of regenerative medicine. He uses your own body's natural healing properties found in blood to heal injured muscles, tendons, and ligaments. The technique that Dr. John Sturgis invented is both safe and effective. It does not involve drugs or surgery and is a great option for sports injuries, repetitive use injuries, and chronic pain. Dr. Sturgis, welcome to the show. John, I've known you for a long time. Thank you for being here today. Tell us a little bit about your story about how you got involved in doing regenerative work with PRP and ACP.
Well, thanks, Sherry. And yes, I've been involved in it for a number of years, and that goes back to actually late 90s. But I have a classmate that was heavily involved in stem cell early research, and he basically took fat cells and realized that they could be or as close to pluripotent as any cell at that time. And that was a long time back, and I ended up building equipment for him. We didn't use that for many years. And that's been since used in my clinic for the last now, 15 years. So.
Yeah. And I think, John, you and I probably started talking about it a little bit because at that time I was seeing so much, work with, DIEP flaps with breast cancer and that sort of thing. And I think I remember Dr. Jim Watson doing some, work in that whole arena, trying to get those DIEP flaps to kind of take better and just have better outcomes. And I remember sort of being fascinated, by all of that. So, as you started working in all of this, tell me in the musculoskeletal world, with knees and shoulders and hips and all of that, tell us how that started to open up and roll with all of this, because, you used a guided technique with musculoskeletal ultrasound to actually guide your injections. And I think that's an amazing way to have this happen.
Well, yes, certainly putting those cells near the field of work is more efficacious. But as time went on, we realized we didn't even need the cells. You just needed the signaling signaling molecules that would actually call your own cells to work. And so that turned out to be just a much cleaner way of doing that. But you still need to know where to send, the body needs to know where to send its equipment to go fix things.
Right. So what happens with these fat cells? Why are they so important? And, what kind of signals are they sending?
The fat cell is just a younger cell in your body because they don't reproduce as much. And so there's, everybody kind of inherently knows that as we get older, cells get slower and slower about reproducing. And fat cells don't turn over as fast, so they tend to be younger. And so that was kind of the early world that where we use SBF and versions of fat cell. There's actually a little pericyte that's inside the fat that is the stem cell for fat, and that cell is, they're in all kinds of organs, they're all over. So ideally for musculoskeletal, you'd probably use the fat out of the knee or cartilage, and then now go and expand those and then put that back in the knee. But it turns out you don't need to do all that work. It's just, there's circulating cells all over that do that. You just need to concentrate in the area that you want the body to start working on. The body kind of forgets to work on a shoulder that, for example, you injured it, and it sends all the messengers to go fix it, but you keep re-injuring it. After a while, it goes, I guess I don't need to do that anymore. And so you wake that all up again what I term wet needling instead of dry needling. So you inject those signaling molecules in there. There's a whole bunch of them. And so it's just endless on how many of them are around. And you put, basically you're putting growth factors into that area to get your shoulder to heal sooner, or in your case, the pelvic floor. So,
right. So, John, I know, you know, we've shared patients through the years doing all of this, and it's a kind of an amazing thing. Talk about the process. Like, if a patient comes into you, you know, maybe has a partial tear of their rotator cuff, like, what's your process of, like, taking care of them? You know, what do you do first, and how do you go through the process? You know, people so much of the time are so afraid of PRP and ACP because they think blood and a big needle, and their eyes get, like, this big, and they're like, no, I'm not going to do that. And I just want people to understand from your perspective, like, how important a thing this is and the stepping stone, like, you know, maybe before surgical interventions, because, you know, maybe somebody really can heal with this first, really, because just like you said, the body stops acting on that site after a while. And so we're just reintroducing all of that. So, like, what's the steps if I send a patient into you, how does it work?
So I'll usually do a consult where I'm looking at and going, is this actually fixable or not? Because a lot of people come in with, like, knees, for example, that may need to just be replaced. And if they're 70, why are we doing, you have old cells anyway, this is going to be harder to get to fix. But now if you get a 45-year-old or, and you can fix people that are older too, I'm not saying that, but if the knee is completely worn out, it ought to be replaced.
Right.
And same thing with the shoulder and stuff like that. And so shoulder's my favorite one to do, because there's so much, you know, the repair process. If you go and replace that, or, you know, anchor down the shoulder, and that surgery, by the way, has come a long way. So surgeries are really good now, but still quite a recovery. And when you can just jump start that with a partial tear out of the cuff, then, you know, why are we putting anchors in there and shortening up your tendons? You know, so that's, and so I look at that shoulder and go, no, that shoulder's completely, those parts aren't even close by. They need to go to the surgeon and have them hook that up. But if it looks like that's a partial tear that couldn't heal, then it's like, well, okay, now we're going, and those will heal about 80% of the time. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Right. And we've seen that so nicely done, you know, where literally, you know, you have a partial tear where something's partly torn and then it just regrows the tendon. I think one of the most dramatic ones, you know, was probably even an elbow one where there was an extensor tendon that looked like it was almost completely gone all the way in the elbow. And I know you did injections with that particular patient, and boy, that was an amazing result where it was like that tendon just regrew itself right back.
Yeah, I remember a case on the elbow where the lady was a very competitor archer, and she was going to shoot 25 arrows every day, no matter what we were going to do. And that's not probably the best way to heal, but we got her to heal, and she'd had multiple things done prior trying to get herself to heal. And all she needed now was that jump start to get that started again. She healed that up, and I can't remember how many people came in from Moses Lake because of that.
Right.
One way is the way to drive in, but, you know, she became quite a little recruiting force about that. So, and that, as far as I know, is still working on her. So that was probably, I don't know, 10 years ago. Yeah.
So, John, if someone comes in, I know you use your musculoskeletal ultrasound. Explain why you do that, because it's really helpful, because I know sometimes when we've been doing shoulders together, you know, a patient might have had a couple injections, was healing well, but then maybe had a couple of other spots, and that ultrasound can pick up things, right?
Yeah, the ultrasound's really good at soft tissue. And so it's not too good at bone. And I'm sure there's variations that can do that, but you can see the bone, you can see a break in it and stuff, but I won't be able to see inside your shoulder, for example, where an MRI can see inside there and then say, wow, you have a labrum tear, or you have a bone that's hooking down and dragging on that tendon. So both tools are actually valuable, but ultrasound tells me where that tendon is. And that's that looks like a partial tear there, or that's a full thickness tear, or you don't even have a tendon there. And so that is an incredible tool for that. And it's right in your office. And then on top of that, you can now, you know, inject, you know, PRP or steroids or whatever you're going to put into that joint. You can now stick that right where you want. And so now if I'm going to put cortisone, for example, I can put half that or even a quarter of the cortisone and get the same effect I used to get, just because I put it nearby and yet not in the tendon, which it has a problem you know, that's a pretty, you know, it cortisone's great for you until you, water's good for you until you drown in it. And so cortisone is made in the body, and yet, you know, too much of it is bad for a tendon. So, and you can put as much, regenerative injections as you want. And, you know, I've done one knee. I did one of my knees just trying to see a toxic effect. And I injected it weekly for 30 weeks straight. Mm-hmm. And that knee is actually better than the other one. So
that's amazing.
So, and if I'd done that with cortisone, it'd been replaced by now. So.
No, that's exactly right. And I think that's a good thing for people to understand. And that's why regenerative medicine, I think, is so important and valuable. And it is getting so much press right now, right? For the very reason of if we can restore musculoskeletal tissue and, you know, avert having to have replacements or avert having to have, you know, multiple surgical procedures, you know, we're way better off. So tell people too the difference between like the ACP and the PRP. And maybe why you use different things for different areas.
Well, way back in the early days, I did PRP, and I still use PRP as a starting place for ACP. And that term PRP is platelet-rich plasma, and people use platelet-poor plasma. They do different things. So PRP is kind of a starting stone for autologous treatments. And so... So if I'm using your blood and not somebody else's, now what part of that blood is important? And that's the PRP part of it, which is where the cells that I'm most interested in. And I don't actually, and then when I convert that into ACP, that's through stressing the cells and then, and you inherently know that you need to stress stuff because you'll go out and work out in the gym every day, and you turned on stem cells in your muscle, and that's why it grew. I mean, that's essentially.
So John, like all the, you know, talk about the inflammatory cytokines too that happen, right, from injections of this sort.
Yeah, a good example of that would be when I'd put PRP in the knee joint. About every, let's just say, one out of every 20 people, it inflamed the knee up, and it's like, okay, no, I do wrong on that one. And I would think that I had injected, you know, did I have a bacterial injection in there? But I'd actually culture that out and be scared and find out, no, it was just a sterile and inflammatory response. And that frightened me. Ultimately, I said, I'm not going to continue doing this. And I've never had a case of that with ACP ever.
Yeah.
And yep, for, I don't know, 15 years of doing this now. So yeah, right. it's a cleaner injection. There's none of those cytokines that would incite inflammation. So.
Right. So that's kind of the beauty like of the work. So when you talk about stressing the cells, so, you know, you usually do what, like you draw their blood. When do you do it? You know, do it same day before? How does that work?
Some of that's proprietary. And so, And some of that is, you know, just know-how, but bottom line is I want somebody to kind of clean up their diet and try to lower their inflammatory response in their blood already. And then, you know, draw a significant amount of blood. And so instead of doing little small tubes of PRP, I'm doing, you know, very large amounts. And that's part of the effectiveness of it all. So now I have kind of that gives me a lot of blood to work with when I'm now trying to fix somebody's shoulder. So.
And John, usually like, do they need like one injection? How many injections do you like to do, or where do you see some good response patterns happening for people?
In a shoulder, my average turns out to be 3 injections. I'll spread those apart, 2 weeks apart. In a knee, I usually go with 4, and probably 5 or 6 is better. And still, all of that's cheaper than if you went and did, I don't know, you know, MSCs. There's lots of stem cell therapies out there, and they just all more expensive, and there's more risk, and especially when you go, okay, let me get cord blood. I mean, that's clearly a higher quality blood, but wow, where did you get that from? You know, I mean, we get pretty nervous when we get blood transfusion from anybody else when in the hospital. Why? And that's a pretty secure system of accessing blood. And we still are nervous about that. I just want my own blood going into me, not somebody else's. And
I know this is such a good question because I want you to talk on that a little bit because it seems like, you know, it's way better to have your own blood than be using something else, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's even like, say if you're getting a kidney transplant or something like that, there's this worry now by the transplant specialists, like, okay, they've had this many graft versus host reactions ahead of time because they've had stem cells. And so that actually goes into their mix of who they're going to do, you know, do transplants later on. Is that you go down on the list because it's like, you know, that one might fail. And so, and really, so having had stem cells actually is a concern that way. Be careful about that. Whereas if you're using your own blood, that has none of that risk.
Mm-hmm.
And those are things that don't get promoted by the, people using, I mean, cord blood is wonderful. It's great. We need to figure that out. But wow, what's going to happen if we're using sheep blood? And that gets used. I mean, so it's like, you know, it's like that about, sounds like that ought to have maybe a real big study going on. So big one.
Yeah. So in your work, you're using a person's own blood when they come in. And so that's kind of why you're saying, hey, you know, if they have, you know, less inflammation in their system and they feel way better, you know, but when you take their blood, then you have better results. Do you feel like, John, do you see better results?
Yes, I do. And, but part of that, you know, has to do with, you know, cleaning up their lifestyle. I mean, a lot of people tear these things because they're probably pre-diabetic and they're, you know, doing stuff that is likely raising inflammatory, you look at a diabetic that can't heal their own, you know, plantar fasciitis or their own things until they kind of get their diabetes under better control. And so those metabolic signaling molecules are all flying around in their blood. Why would you want to use that at that time? You know, clean up that diet, really start eating better, exercising more, and then now treat them and just better outcomes. And maybe they're getting better anyway because they were eating better anyway. And then back to your start, we actually followed that. It's like, let's just inject that in there and magically watch that they heal. But the body doesn't know what to heal unless they actually saw a therapist and said, oh, let's exercise that and start helping the tendons around your supraspinatus that's torn. Let's now have the substiop. And it's, the other tendons can support that. And now their supraspinatus heals up without actually tearing more and more each time you work it out. And that's where the therapist can become really critical as part of the treatment. It's not just simply injecting and running off. So
what usually happens is that, you know, John injects somebody and then we end up seeing them in physical therapy, you know, maybe 2 to 3 days later. And then we're helping our people through that process so that we're helping rebuild the tissue. And that's sort of what he's speaking to right now is that, you know, you need to actually stress that tissue once that injection happens. You know, you don't do it early. And you're doing it in a controlled way, but at the same time, you want that tissue to have information, right? And the neurological part in the tissue to actually integrate. Yes.
Okay. I lost your image. There, it's coming back. So.
Okay, good.
But another thing, you pointed out that stress, there was in the knee, there was a fascinating study where, you know, they would do a lot of work, like, you know, let's you know, cut out a piece of the cartilage and then now, you know, put a pledget of, you know, stem cells right there on that bald piece of bone. And now let's support that. And then the person, there's a physician over in Malaysia is really figuring his stem cells were kind of behind the times with some of this stuff. But, you know, he figured out that no, just moving the knee wasn't that good. You actually had to put pressure on that. And it's like, and yet if you put a lot of pressure and then wiped off all those cells, that didn't go any good. So it was just like standing pressure turned out to be very important for, you know, making, you know, fibrocartilage go into circling cartilage. And so that it shows, you know, you have all those little nuances that, you know, that takes a therapist to know that stuff. It's not just somebody winging it because they went out and.
Right. Like we're not
off of Google. Yep. So.
Right. Yeah, we're not overworking the tissue, but we're actually just asking it to actually move and do things, right? And I think we saw that with a lot of the patients we treated early on, you know, where, you know, maybe, you know, oh, if we push too hard, then, you know, it was too much. And, oh, no, we need to come back and sort of find the fine line of like, okay, hey, we need information to the tissue, but not over information. I think that's the important part.
Absolutely.
I remember, you know, one person you injected the first time, you know, he came back over in our clinic and he like whipped his arm up. He started doing all this stuff. And I was like, wait, hold the door. I was like, no, I said, step back. Yes, we're going to work the tissue, but we're going to do it in a slower, methodical way. You know, maybe not quite above 90 yet because there's too much compression yet, you know, up there. Let's slow down. Let's work lower. And I think that really is the component where all of this, I'm just saying in the musculoskeletal world, when you're using stem cell, it works so much better to have like this collaborative, I think, team approach. And I think that's, you know, what we've been doing all these years.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember one football player that I'm sure, well, he had a torn labrum. And so we ended up treating him through the football season. And it was very frustrating because he just got there and get injured again. But he could actually play through the whole season or the rest of that season. And then it was within like weeks of football ending and suddenly the labrum heals up. So he was working that up too far.
Too hard, too far. Right.
Yes.
I know. The best day of the season is the first day of the season, right? The rest of the season. Everybody's always injured the rest of the season. But I mean, I think this is where, you know, the things come in, you know, with some of our athletes. So I'm just going to bring this up. A lot of our athletes might be training towards something and you and I are trying to keep them moving, you know, at least so they can get to their event, right? On some of this stuff.
Yeah.
And some of that work has worked well, at least to get them to their big event with, you know, I think the ACP from the work that we've been doing.
Yeah. A classic for that is somebody will like tear their proximal hamstring, you know, running or something like that for an Ironman. And they already paid for their Ironman. And it's like, okay, just back off a little bit here. Just keep the running, maybe go ahead and inject that. And then they heal that up really quickly. But they have gone 6 months prior to it. So we know it. It's some of the trick healing.
Right. And I think that's the beauty. I mean, you and I have talked about this before about dry needling versus wet needling. Will you just talk a little bit about that? Because I think sometimes people, you know, don't understand like when you're putting that needle in, you know, a whole process starts. So what is the process that starts when you're actually getting a needle that goes into a region?
Well, I think, you know, the Chinese obviously figured out, you know, with acupuncture that, wow, this dry needling thing really works. I think the therapists have probably modified that a little bit and actually use it in what I consider probably a more legitimate portion there. But leave it to those Chinese, they really figured this out really well. But I have seen that change because I've had acupuncture done. To be fair, it was different people, but it's amazing that does that. You know, but I think you can take that a whole other level up by actually injecting something in. So using regenerative injections, you know, that can take that up a whole nother level. So, but also takes risk step too. So, you know, you think about it, you're putting a dry needling is actually doesn't have a core in there. Now you put a hollow core needle into somebody and accidentally get into their joint that because they had a torn torn supraspinatus and it's torn wide open. Now you stuck that right in the joint and you cored in a piece of bacteria. You're just giving them an infection. I mean, it's like, really? That sounds dangerous to me. And it's like, so probably the Chinese all figured that out and put them in different places and try to just stay away from that and I think they were pretty smart people. So, you know, I think, you know, remember the needle technology has come a long way. So there are finer needles in there. And you can make them so cheaply now that you just throw them away and use new ones and all that stuff. Whereas Chinese obviously didn't do that. So they probably were more careful about that and moved it further away. Had these meridians and all these other things that we've had a hard time understanding. But probably comes back to your world is that you have all those lymphatics that nobody knew about before. That's like, or understood. Yep. And that probably was carrying stuff around that we didn't quite understand as well. And, and then who knows all the other signaling pathways that we don't understand quite yet.
John, so like, I know you and I have seen this with patients where, you know, you might be injecting somebody's shoulder, but then all of a sudden their knee that was a problem all of a sudden feels better as well with these ACP injections. So you inject their shoulder and suddenly they're telling you, oh, my knee feels better too, or my other joint that hurt doesn't feel as bad. What do you think is going on in that whole world with regenerative care?
I know if people do IV injections and stuff like that, but a lot of that stuff just filters out in the lung. So the thing that probably did the best good is you help their COPD, you know, so, or other things like that. And I've seen that actually happen. So that's not that truly is that. So to go stick that in your vein and then expect your shoulder to get better is probably really low. It's likely. But if you go down and stick your elbow and then that's running by your shoulder, you might get some two of those to get better because that's going to go back by lymphatics and all the other things. And so now all of a sudden your shoulder is in that pathway and likely does, you know, help some of that signaling there. And certainly nearby, I still remember one guy that was, we had a clinic that we were setting up over in Tokyo and this a pro golfer that had a shoulder that was really bothering him. And it turned out he had a tear in there. He had lots of cortisone and I mean, these multiple seasons of treatment that he'd had and the physician that injected that was stumbling on, you know, trying to get it in the right place. You know, ultrasound equipment had never used that basically before. And it's of all people to mess up on. And that person made it. And then I didn't see the next two injections, to be fair about that, but likely did better on those. But came back on after the third one, I was going every 3 months going over there and made a special trip in to thank him because his shoulder is fine at that point. He's still doing well, by the way.
That's great.
And from what I could tell, they missed. And it's like, I hope they did better on the other ones, but it was like, you know, it kind of needs to be in the area, but it doesn't necessarily have to be in the tendon, you know, which can hurt a lot more. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember
I typically do put it in the tendon, but I think it works better. And the ultrasound helps with all that, but you have to get, it's a lot of practice in ultrasound to do that right. So,
Well, and I think that's sort of what I've seen with the way you use ultrasound. It's such a better technique. I mean, I remember one man, rotator cuff, he was doing really great. And then there was just this still pain pattern like he had in the front area. And it was kind of crazy. And we kept saying, oh, well, what went on, you know, when you actually got hurt and realized that, you know, some of his tension might have, or, you know, tearing might have been in the subscap. And it was just interesting because, you know, just with the ultrasound, you kind of went right into that spot. And you literally were able to identify, happened to be in the room that day with you. And we were able to see exactly where it was. And then you literally, you know, could put that right in. And this guy literally in probably 3 or 4 weeks was, you know, done because he was so much better because you had already injected some of the other spots, but there was just this one little area that was missing. And I think that's sort of the beauty of, you know, ultrasound and being so specific because you had injected other tendons and he had done really well, but he still just had this one area that just wasn't quite better all the way. And I think that's the beauty. And I think people need to understand why ultrasound is a part of what you do.
Oh, absolutely. Well, had a big learning curve for physicians trying to, or whoever is that, and quality difference between one unit and another. And you can get much, you know, really high quality ultrasounds, but there's just too many buttons. You can't figure out how to use that unless that's your daily use thing. And I probably took my unit, you know, mine was a very portable unit. And I took that thing home with me every night for a year straight. I never did not take it home. And there was not a safe, you know, elbow in the room or whoever, you know, cause I kept honing that down and that was a big effort. And now, you know, students come out of medical school. I know the school I came out, they were recruiting, of course, you know, money for the school. But say I had a picture of everybody instead of wearing their, you know, their stethoscopes, they were wearing ultrasound probes around their neck. It was just like, And it's true that, you know, it's just different now where how people are, you know, trained and trained better. Yeah. So, and it's like, you know, watching a kid with a computer, they can just do it so easily. And so
that's for sure.
Have learned that in their early days, it's much easier to try to adapt into now having guided injections and stuff like that. I mean, just starting an IV with an ultrasound is so much easier than, absolutely, you know, trying to just blindly go in and start an IV. Mm-hmm. You know,
and I think that point of it is so important because, you know, if you're going to go to the cost, because most of this is cash based, right? So if you're going to go to the cost of actually having, you know, PRP or ACP injections, it's so much better to actually get the injection exactly where you need it. And that whole piece, I think, of the musculoskeletal ultrasound in that real time, because I remember, just like we were talking about with this guy, like so specifically, you know, him actually going through the range of motion of his arm while you were ultrasounding. And we were like, oh, there it is. There it is. And I think, you know, it would have been easy just to kind of blindly be like, oh, I'm just going to inject that area when, you know, and when people are paying cash for something like that, and to know that you're able to do it so specifically and so directly and know, hey, this is exactly where it is and this is exactly what we need to do. And then, you know, his ability then to, you know, to heal so quickly afterwards because it was so specific, you know, to the region. And I think, you know, that's the beauty of it. So, because right now it is cash everywhere and nobody is paying for it with insurances. And, you know, that can be a barrier for people.
It's interesting you bring up that insurance. I did not expect in my lifetime to see insurance start covering this, but they are actually starting to cover now. And part of this is because it's a cheaper form of therapy. And it tends to be in self-insured groups. And an example of that would be Cenex is a, you know, it's pretty much worldwide. It's owned by Old Castle, I think was the name, but they self-insure. And so suddenly here's cement workers, you know, truck drivers or whatever that actually get that covered. And it's like, well, when is Blue Cross going to jump in on this? You know, when is some of the bigger insurance companies? And I think they will. They just need to have somebody show that, hey, you know, this does work. But those studies are just too onerous for somebody that's done a lot of injection. After a while, you just go, you know, people just beat you up for whatever you did. And so I don't want to, you know, I don't want that done. So there's not very good studies that are out there on that because one guy, Matt, had the fortune to meet, just amazing guy out of Germany that, you know, he tried to publish multiple times and people just beat him all up for what he did. And he's an incredible orthopedist that, you know, the stuff that, you know, he accomplished in the early days on that. And you look at that and you go, you know, after a while, he's just like, I'm done with this. And so then the nice big, you know, case studies that could go on, you know, those could be all published right now. I mean, you know, I kept track of all of mine just because I had this idea that we had this one guy that spent a lot of money with us and, you know, we expected him to, you know, kind of run with this and, you know, carry that ball. And after a while, he realized this is just a cost center and that just wasn't, you know, he had no interest in the study part of it. And so that needs to be funded at a, you know, on a level that, you know, either by the insurance companies or somebody else needs to fund that in a way that's very meaningful. And I actually had an insurance company call me up this year wanting that very data. And so I thought, well, this may actually happen in my lifetime. So it's like, you know, that'd be really cool. You know, so.
No kidding. It would be very exciting. But yeah.
Yeah. There's no doubt it's got a safer pathway and no doubt that, you know, that it works. The problem is trying to prove that and choosing the cases in a way that it actually does that. And that's a learning curve for every single person doing that is like, oh, that should work. Cause it's like, that's not likely going to get better. You know, why are we doing this? This needs to be operated on, or this needs to do some other pathway. And then why aren't the orthopedists then going, okay, I'm going to accelerate my healing after I've operated on that. And there are clinics that do that. And I've had the blessing of being part of those. And, you know, here's these athletes that, you know, everything is about, you know, can I get back in one game sooner than otherwise. And so they would have that injected a couple times, and then the tendon's bigger. Now they anchor it down, and now they inject that another 2-3 times, and they're still back in on that season. And I think the Ravens had like 3 people that came in for their last game this year. And I was like, that had to be somebody doing that, because, you know, how would 3 people show up on the last, you know, game, you know, with those injuries? And they had something done that is, I don't know what was done, but something had to have been done to accelerate that feeling. So.
Right. And I think that's the beauty of the ACP and the PRP work, right? Because you are accelerating the healing, you know, factor. Yeah,
that's exactly, if it's not healable, it's not going to get better. You know, if there's a big spur digging into that tendon, that needs to be taken off. Yes. Yeah.
John, out of all the, because you've been doing it for 15 years, out of all of the, you know, you love the shoulder, I know that, but like what biggest changes or like advances have you seen in the last 15 years, you know, just moving from the PRP to the ACP, or like in your own, you know, mind, like what were the biggest things you've seen happen that have impressed you the most maybe with all of this?
I think, you know, molecular biology has just moved so far, learning about all the signaling molecules. And so there's, you know, exosomes when I was in medical school was trash that was urinated out of somebody. And now they're collecting those and putting that into people. It's like, so that's just one of the many different things that there. The problem is when you go and buy that product, you just bought that one product. What about all the stuff I can make? Have your own body make for you. And it's like, okay, you just got 15 products that, you know, I injected in there. That's the beauty. And so the trouble with that whole process is it's going to have to be done by, you know, a lab that actually processes that for people. This is too onerous for the individual physician in some small clinic trying to do that on his own. It's too expensive. And it needs to be done right. And so then that, therefore, needs to have a lab that will be sprung up all around the United States that now processes people's blood for the orthopedists that now actually have the most skill at putting that into the right place. And then now having that orthopedist send you to that lab, go get this done, bring that back, rather than buying that from some, you know, company that's making that someplace, which is another way to do that, but it's going to get an isolated product, not the component of everything for that person.
Because it's their own blood, right? Is kind of what you're saying. So then you would have to teach these labs how to do all of that, right?
Oh, and there's labs all around the country that could do that. They're already there. I mean, what about the blood labs? No, they could be just automatically rolled over to do this. And so, and then now you just go to a place where you donate blood anyway. And, you know, it'd be just so easy for them, but they have to know that that's what they're going to be doing. And that has to be trained. Yeah, but that's where this is going, and it will happen. It's just, you know, who's going to lead that charge, and it'll be an insurance company.
Yeah. So. Well, and yeah, because think of it, you know, I mean, in my own practice, I feel like the PRP and the ACP is my first line of defense. If I have a person who has a partial tear in the rotator cuff, I'm like, oh no, this is.
But that's because you happen to be next to a guy that did that, you know, and. But, you know, who has that? And it's kind of scary when you, like, I remember, I don't know, it's just like, you know, when people saved their kid's cord blood for potentially getting cancer later or some other treatment, that turned out that never got really used for that purpose. And so after a while, you wouldn't pay your bills. And then what did that company do with that blood? And, you know, and then that ended up getting sold, but that's all gone now. And so that got sold off by companies that were based loosely in areas that didn't have rules for that. And so it's like, wow, so where are they getting all this cord blood? And that gets frightening when you actually know the who does the transporting. You go, okay, where are they basing this out of? And there's countries that, you know, make a lot of money selling us that. And it's like, okay, when there's a pile of money on the floor, somebody's going to run off with that. And it's like, so, you know, what shortcuts are they going to do? And that just gets, you know, that needs to be done by secure, you know, I mean, our blood industry of our country is so good that other countries buy our blood from us, you know, and that's like Japan or, you know, they don't They don't trust their own. I don't know, maybe it's religion. I don't know what it is, but they buy our blood and use our blood. So obviously we have the best way of processing blood in the U.S. Why aren't we using that? And then using that for autologous, you know, conditioned plasma, which is what ACP stands for.
So do you think, John, that it's just hard? You know, I'm just thinking in the ortho and sports world, is it just, you know, if they don't have access to good labs or they don't have the ability to do that, they're not utilizing the technology? I mean, you have to get so specific or have to be trained so specific. And that's the next thing I was going to ask you. You know, you kind of self-trained yourself, obviously. And
well,
so
I was training other people too. So yeah. That makes you pretty good at what you're doing yourself. But when you look at that, I remember I turned 60 and that very day broke my ankle, and you know, shows what aging can do on the very first day of seeing. But went and had that plated, and I remember that was all done. I just loved how this orthopedist, you know, because she said, John, just go through this again. What are you doing? And I quickly gave a little quick spin down of, you know, what I do. And he just said it so well. And I just loved his honesty about this. He goes, well, John, I don't want to be the last guy doing this, but I also don't want to be the first. And he has everything to lose and nothing to gain. Why would you do that? You know? And so then it's left to all these quotes, cowboys out there or pioneers or whatever we want to call us is, you know, tried to figure it out on our own to do that. This needs to be figured out and there's really good companies out there that are doing that. You know, I don't want to use names right now, but they're very good companies that are actually spread around the country doing this. And very thing that I'm doing, I just happen to be my own version of that. But there's excellent companies out here that are doing that. And interesting, they all have to be based out of Colorado, it looks like. So that reason, I do know the reasons, but it's an interesting world. Why would Colorado be so open to this? Well, you know, they're kind of open to marijuana or, you know, all the different reasons that they are more open to stem cells. But, you know, Colorado is very early about this. And I give it to Colorado. That's good. You know, that was a good thing they did. So.
Well, and they also have a high, you know, I mean, if you look at their population, they have a healthy population base overall. And they seem to take care of themselves, you know, at a higher rate if you look at their health and wellness overall. So, John, we're just going to, you know, finish up with everything we've been talking about. And, you know, is there other things that you want to share about, like, the future of this? I know we talked a little bit about the labs. We talked a little bit about, you know, better, you know, our country having such good collection of blood, and maybe that makes it easier, you know, for actual orthopedists and physicians to work with this in the musculoskeletal world. What other vision or things do you see maybe that could be prominent with this and the way you work with it?
Learned early on is that stem cells themselves, or very youthful cells is a better way of saying that, have very high levels of NAD. And now that's pretty accessible to most people. And NAD, you know, just everything heals better. I mean, we use it in our own clinic for, you know, brain health. And so if somebody has PTSD or something like that, you can help their PTSD profoundly with NAD. Well, that's because now their brain is, you know, you went to Vietnam, you came back, you did pretty well for those years because you're young. And then you got older, you start getting dreams and can sleep, and, you know, it just gets worse and worse. And it's like bring their NAD levels up and suddenly they don't have as much PTSD because their brain is actually younger. Well, then what about your cells? And that's where this all came about. I mean, NAD, we got very interested in it because of shoulder injections, you know, so that's where that came from. And well, then why aren't we doing that before we draw your blood? You know, if you're going to spend all this money, you might as well do it right. You know, so it's like, now if you're young anyway, that's fine. But if you're like 70, you probably should do an NAD infusion or two. And now get blood, or why not do that before you went into surgery? And then also for the 3 months after surgery. I mean, there's so many things that could be potentially helpful for, you know, accelerating healing.
So, John, is that kind of how you got into the NAD world?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's, the ACP, you know, and PRP,
it was used by one person in the United States, a wonderful man. I mean, great, since 2000. And it's been around a lot longer than that and known for what it could use. But the guy that was doing that, he was a psychiatrist. So everything about him was, you know, what psychiatric benefits would that be? The orthopedist, you know, didn't realize that, wow, this could help musculoskeletal. And I'm not an orthopedist, I'm family practice. But the you know, there's so many other areas that you could help accelerate healing if you just act younger, and that usefulness of those cells can be helped by things like NAD or just eating better.
So, John, will you tell people a little bit about NAD and just, you know, the whole, you know, how the delivery system of it, and there's different delivery systems, et cetera, but, you know, what do you feel about the drip versus, you know, patches versus, you know, oral things that people take? Tell NAD, us a little bit about that.
Clearly
with
the best way is you're going to put it in IV, but you know, that's expensive, partly because you have to sit there for a long time trying to get that. And, you know, there's places that will give you it for an hour and now go back to gamble here. And so that's with little bars like in Las Vegas or something like that you can get done. But to now really turn on your own ability to make that, you need to sit down for about 5 hours. You need to do a bigger workout. And the NAD that we are giving people is the, you know, the depleted NAD or the discharged version of it. So then the body gets kind of frightened into making more. And so that's why the durability of NAD works so well. And so that if you're going to do it IV. So IV is clearly the best way to do that. And the same thing works that way for other. I mean, there's wonderful studies on and like taking vitamin C that shows it doesn't work until you do IV.
I appreciate your info on the NAD because I think it's an important thing for people to understand, like taking it before a surgical procedure, taking it after a surgical procedure. It really does help. And, you know, we see it even in the concussion world, even, you know, with kids with concussions that have had multiple concussions, they're doing really well with NAD. And it's those things that you want people to understand in the regenerative medicine world, right? Like these are part of all of it.